to have to wait for that. Yeah, I just thought I would front the sort of political report with the United States. I'm not a sort of a student of US politics, but we're all affected by the US, not just because Britain, of course, is the United States' most important loyal ally, attack dog, but also because the United States remains the global hegemon. Hence what happens in the United States very, very much matters when it comes to looking at the potential, which is very remote, I admit, of a Jeremy Corbyn government, but more realistically, the prospect of a Keir Starmer government, the Ukraine war, and goddamn everything else. So, just to begin, what's happened? Well, we've had the beginning of impeachment proceedings. That's an inquiry into whether there ought to be. That's basically it. The Republicans have used their slim majority, or at least expected to use their slim majority to that effect. This is Kevin McCarthy. And basically, what Joe Biden stands accused of, not guilty, of course, accused of, is abuse of power, obstruction, and corruption. Well, I don't know, but certainly when it comes to at least the sort of superficial evidence, there does seem to be, evidence that would back that one up. We all know about the famous laptop. We know about this drug addicted son who ends up as an advisor to Ukrainian gas and oil concerns. And we seem to have evidence of kickback. I don't know whether it's the old man, anyway. But everyone assumes that's the then vice president who got his share of it. So, of course, the Democrats scream out that this is an abuse of the Republican majority. This is quote unquote extreme politics at its worst. I sort of scratch my head and go, well, I do remember the beginning of the Trump presidency, and I do remember the hearings, and we all knew what the result would be, i.e., Trump wouldn't end up being impeached, but we know that this was used as a political weapon, and that seems to be the case this time. And of course, the Republicans, crucially, the Trump camp would also be claiming now that his legal troubles are also the result of, get it right, extreme politics at its worst. In other words, the legal system is being used to preempt, maybe that's the right word, preempt a political argument that instead of having an election, what you have is a Democrat attempt to bar Trump. Failing that, you have a Democrat attempt to imprison Trump. And you could end up with the bizarre situation of President Trump, prisoner number XXXXXX. I don't know. Either way, of course, this whole impeachment process against Biden goes hand in hand, I think, with genuine concern for his mental state. Now, when you're 80, it doesn't automatically mean that you're losing it. Far from it. I know plenty of 80-year-olds that have got all their marbles. On the other hand, when I listen to Joe Biden, I'm not convinced that he's got all of his marbles. We all know with Ronald Reagan. Again, this is really back in the, in the midst of my memory somewhere back there. Wasn't Ronald Reagan, didn't he call the Prince of Wales Princess Diana or something like that? I mean, all this muddle, it was clear that Ronald Reagan, was losing it. And it just strikes me that it's equally clear that Joe Biden is losing it. And however much the Democrats go on about Trump's garbled speeches and all the rest of it, he, in contrast, comes over as sharp and vicious in debate. And I don't know, again, whether it's not compulsory, is it? But I can guess who would come over better in a TV debate, presuming that they are both candidates for the presidency. It's clearly going to be Trump. And however many cue cards they put in front of Biden, the fact of the matter is, in a debate, what you rely on is not only what you've learned, not only what you've been coached to say, it's that instant rejoinder, that instant response, that instant put down that you have to think on your feet if you're going to respond effectively. And so, it's just like in the House of Commons, what in terms of our politics, and I'm talking about mainstream politics, you have to have a quick mind. And if you haven't got a quick mind, then you need to be, how should I put it, looking for a different job. So obviously the presidential system is different. Biden could avoid a TV debate with Trump, but under those circumstances, clearly one of the major lines of attack from Trump isn't Biden's age. I mean, he's only what, 3, 4 years younger? No, but it's his mental capability, his mental capacity. And if he doesn't, go up in front of the TV cameras, with Trump, then that message can be hammered home time and time again. So what it looks like, potentially, and I'm very reluctant on this, and I'll say why in a second, but it looks quite possible that what you could get, amongst many possibilities, is Joe Biden elected just like last time, but instead of a Joe Biden presidency, what you get is a Harris presidency. With Joe Biden either being voluntarily, stepped down or stepped down because of the vice president and the majority of the cabinet. And I think that then I'm not sure whether that has to be confirmed by Congress. Either way, that will be the Republican line of attack. And the fact of the matter is, at the moment, while you have remarkably, at least from this side of the pond, Biden and Trump running neck and neck when it comes to popularity or lack of popularity, but it has to be said, popularity, doesn't it? What you've got with Harris is someone who's way down there. So, the idea of a Trump presidency, I think we would be very, very foolish to discount that possibility in spite of, the huge legal challenges that he faces. And then you, I mean, I'm not wanting to get too far down the track, but then you have to say, well, what the hell would happen then? And I think you have to be talking surely about a constitutional crisis of mega proportions. I mean, I remember with January the 6th, the stories that came out afterwards with General Milley saying, don't obey the fascists, only obey my orders. And what he meant by the fascist was the commander in chief. He was telling his people, don't obey the commander in chief, obey the chief of staff. So precisely what then happens in the United States? I mean, is there going to be a coup, this time an effective coup, as opposed to January the 6th, which was an ineffective coup? What then happens to this model of, you know, the shining example on the hill and bourgeois democracy? What message does that then convey about US hegemony and the stability of the United States? What message does that convey about the stability of the dollar? What happens with the Ukraine war? One just carries on. The reason, by the way, just as a footnote, I'm very skeptical when I hear experts lined up in the media. And as I understand it, and I'm just too young to remember, so I've read this recently, but when Goldwater, remember, some of you are a bit older than me, when Barry Goldwater ran as president, he was the sort of far right candidate. And my memory, not my memory, my recent memory is that 1,000 psychiatrists were lined up in America to sign off on the idea that the man is crazy. Don't vote for him because he's mad. And of course, we've had this in terms of more recent politics about Putin. So I'm not putting myself up there saying I know what's going on with Biden, but it and I'm not a psychiatrist, so you know, I'm just an ordinary Joe you know, in these circumstances. But it does strike me that he is losing it. And as I said, you know, when you've got a presidential system, that most certainly matters. And it most certainly matters when you've got a presidential system and an oncoming presidential election. Okay, having dealt with Joe himself, we've then got Hunter. I've already mentioned the laptop, but we've also got, you know, gun problems with him. And I had to go, what are these problems? So I actually had to look it up because, I mean, what I know about America is that they got guns everywhere. So what's this about, you know, the president's son having a problem with guns? Well, precisely the problem with the son having a problem with guns is he was an addict. He was a drug addict. And I don't know whether these are state laws or federal laws. Either way, that's his violation. So he was a drug addict who had two guns. I think that's the least of the problems, though, with Hunter Biden, as I've already indicated. Okay. Okay, let's move on. The reason, by the way, comrades, I might occasionally put dark glasses on is because I've just had an eye operation and I haven't got curtains. So it's not meant to be a sort of mafia pose or anything like that. Okay, I want to turn now to the Trade Union Congress. This has just been meeting up in Liverpool. And it did produce an interesting resolution on the trade unions defying the latest round of Tory anti-trade union laws. These are the laws that would require unions going on strike in the public sector, such as, for example, we've just had the British Medical Association come out, for strike action, which is going to be not only junior doctors, which is people who are not fully into taking senior position. It sounds like they're sort of trainee doctors, but they're not. But also consultants, top doctors. And of course, the result of that is that Rishi Sunak will not meet his five pledges. You know, waiting lists in Britain are going up and up and up. But more to the point, it will be doctors, it will be, you know, border control people, it will be prison workers, it will be train drivers, it will be people who, you know, staff stations on the railway, bus drivers. All of them will have to provide a minimum level of service if their industrial action is to remain legal. And what we've had is a resolution. I admit that that doesn't mean much, but a resolution is a beginning to defy that legislation. That's very positive. And of course, what we now need to see is a campaign to get unions to carry out that pledge in practice. And so what we've got, again, welcome, is the promise of a national TUC demonstration against these laws. But I would also simply raise the point that what we've had since way back with Margaret Thatcher is one wave or one round of anti-trade union legislation after another, all of which at the end of the day, the trade unions ended up complying with. And the only exception to that was pre-Thatcher. And what we had is pre-Thatcher, we had Edward Heath, and he introduced a round of anti-trade union laws called the Industrial Relations Act. And that was defied, and that was defied successfully. There was one union that complied with registering as an official trade union. That was the Electricians Union, led by a notorious ex-communist, anti-communist called Frank Chappell. They complied with the law, but the vast bulk of the TUC didn't. And indeed, what we had famously is five dockers basically saying, okay, we're going on strike. We're not going to accept this legislation. The dockers come out, the police are sent and arrest these five dockers. And the TUC was forced into a position of threatening a one-day general strike unless they were released. But of course, what was going on in the meantime is something called the Committee for the Defence of Trade Unions, led by the Communist Party, was actually organising walkouts throughout the country. So what was called Fleet Street, the press came out, the printing workers came out, building workers came out, car workers came out, you know, coal miners came out. Hundreds of thousands of workers were already taking directly political action. And what we saw is it was the Tory government that blinked, and they sent in someone called, I'd never heard of them before. I can't even remember their name now, but I think it's something like, anyway, a legal commissioner said, oh, I think that they should be released. We all knew that Ted Heath had suffered a major political defeat. And that culminated in the second miners' strike, where Ted Heath called a general election over it and said, who rules Britain? Is it the trade unions or is it your elected government? And he was voted out. I would love to see a repetition of such a scenario. I'm just sceptical about it. It's not because I have any great faith in the old official Communist Party. Back in the early 70s, I was a member. I knew all of its problems. Nevertheless, you had that organization, and that organization was not only organized geographically, it was organized industrially. It had a real influence in the trade union movement from the top, but crucially in the base. And there is nothing like that at present. Nonetheless, that gives us something to fight around. So that's a positive outcome. Showing why we should, I think, be skeptical, what we had by a very large margin is a vote basically to line up the TUC with British foreign policy. And what we're talking about here is Tory party foreign policy, but also Labour foreign policy, and also, of course, the foreign policy of the United States. And what I'm referring to is the overwhelming vote. This is a composite motion, watered down, that originated with the General Municipal Workers. I think they're something like the third largest union in Britain. They were responsible last year for a narrow vote that supported increased defence spending. But this year, what we had is an overwhelming vote in solidarity with Ukraine. There was lots of talk of workers' rights and being opposed to imperialism. And what we had is, most of the time, of course, the workers' rights that were being referred to is workers' rights suppressed by Russian imperialism, not Zelensky, not NATO expansion, not the United States engaged in a struggle to do down its only serious rival to become an imperialist hegemon at the present time, i.e. China. Europe potentially could become a challenger, but not while the EU and this sort of Ruritanian constitution remains. We had Mark Sawatka, a general secretary of the PCS, a civil service and white collar union, former member of the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, a social imperialist organization, denying that this was a proxy war. Yeah, but Mark, you can find US generals, you can find US senators precisely saying what it is. This isn't simply a Russian invasion. It's certainly not just a civil war in Ukraine that Russia has intervened on. We need to see it in the wider picture. And the wider picture is that Russia and the expansion of NATO are part of a grand game played out by the United States to reestablish its global hegemony. That's what AUKUS is all about. That's what the alliance with India is all about. That's what the struggle about the South China Sea is all about. That's what, you know, all the stuff about Chinese spies in the House of Commons and clampdown in terms of Chinese infiltration of the Tory party. That's what all these stories are really about. Okay, so we did have some honourable exceptions, very few. I have to say I'm very pleased to note one of the exceptions was the Fire Brigades Union, led by Nick Rack. He, you know, I don't know exactly what his position is.
Matt Rack.
Matt, did I say Nick? Thank you, Stan. Yeah, I tend to get the two brothers mixed up, so thanks for the correction. I don't know what his exact position on the Ukraine war is, but the delegation, their speakers spoke well, and they voted against it. And that's also true with the Bakers Union. Again, we're talking about a small union. Nonetheless, they also took a principal position. We also had abstentions from the NEU, that's National Education Union, the UCU, surprising but good, that's the University Lecturers Union, and also the RMT, you know, positive. But what we had is that Britain's second union, Unite, they voted for it with some umming and ahhing. And so what you had is Unison, GMB, Unite, and then all the rest, basically, as I said, with very few exceptions. And indeed, what we had, you almost can't believe it, can you? We had various people. The past is always a safe country. We had various speakers comparing what's going on with Ukraine to the Spanish Civil War. It's just risible. I mean, we all remember it, don't we? I mean, from our history books, of course. Britain, the United States, France, busily channeling in arms and supplies to the Republican side. Of course, we don't remember any such thing. We had hostile neutrality from the great imperialist powers and feigned neutrality, of course, from the Soviet Union, and of course, active involvement by the forces of Mussolini, Italy, and Hitler, Germany. The past is always a safe ground where right wingers, social imperialists can pretend to be left wing. They're not left wing. They're right wing. They've sold out. They are going over to the same side as the government, which is imposing the anti-trade union laws, which they just passed a motion against. To be consistent, you need to recognize that the main enemy is at home. And that also means opposing their foreign policy, because foreign policy is a continuation of domestic policy. They don't exist in two separate compartments. One is a subsidiary of the other. So Joe Biden has got Joe Biden's Democrat agenda, and that is applied both at home and abroad. They form a unity. They're not separate. What is worrying also, though not surprising, is that after the TUC, I get the distinct whiff of a witch hunt being got up. We've already gone through the anti-Corbyn, anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism witch hunt. I get the distinct impression that what we're getting now that the Ukraine war looks like, as we've always suggested, at least since very early on, to be, a protracted war of attrition as opposed to a swift victory. I thought, well, I never thought Russia would achieve a swift victory, but hey, they could have taken Kiev. The government, Zelensky government, could have sued for peace, perhaps. Either way, what we've got now is clear evidence that the summer offensive, call it the spring offensive if you want, hasn't made a breakthrough, hardly advanced a mile or two. So what we've now got, I think, is other weapons being used, and it's being used in particular against Stop the War Coalition. Now, of course, Stop the War Coalition, like most of the left in Britain, pushes the idea of peace. It's a social pacifist position. Of course, we prefer infinitely social pacifism to social imperialism. Of course, we will criticize social pacifism for simply breeding the illusion that the Rishi Sunak government, the Biden government, the Keir Starmer government, could pursue lovely, pro-human politics. This is delusional, comrades. But nonetheless, what we seem to have is some sort of campaign against Stop the War Coalition coming from the usual suspects, i.e., from former left wingers, people who can purport can put themselves forward as I'm a left winger. It doesn't work, does it, if a Rishi Sunak calls for Stop the War Coalition to close down or calls them at all in the hands of imperialism. That doesn't work. But when it comes from someone, for example, I think they were writing in the Independent, this is one Andrew Fisher, who used to be an advisor to Jeremy Corbyn, someone who was also associated with the Labour Representation Committee, chaired, honorary chaired by John McDonnell, the former ch shadow chancellor. Basically, his article said, I was very proud to march back in the early 2000s. I was one of the 1.5 million. There was an unpopular war. There was an unjust war, Andrew says. But now it's all changed. And what we have is Stop the War Coalition making excuses for Russia and not calling for Russia to leave Ukraine, which is just not true, actually. The fact of the matter is that Stop the War Coalition, I think, wrongly, often when it comes to demonstrations, put Russia out at the as their main slogan. And then they follow it with no more NATO expansion, etc., peace talks and all the rest of it. Either way, he's been joined by Paul Mason, someone who's been touted to stand in Islington North. This is Jeremy Corbyn's constituency. Remember, Jeremy Corbyn is still a member of the Labour Party, but he's not being allowed to stand in the Labour Party, even though the constituency want him to stand. So one possibility is to parachute in someone who can talk the language of the left. This is someone who used to be in a group called Workers' Power, and then joined, I think, Permanent Revolution, and has written a lot of rather silly books that are purportedly anti-capitalist. But actually, if you look at these books, what they are is actually pro-capitalist. It's the language of anti-capitalism, but it's actually pro-capitalism because what Paul Mason has done, he's basically adopted the politics of Peter Struve. And I'm talking about a younger Peter Struve, the guy that wrote the first manifesto of the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party. And this is the politics of accelerationism, the politics of development. And basically, what our Paul does, he thinks that supercomputers, he thinks that nuclear power, he thinks the acceleration of capitalist progress will liberate humanity. He thinks the internet will liberate humanity because things will become free. And if things become free, they have no value. Capitalism ceases to be possible. So the agency of change becomes technology and not the self-liberation struggle of the working class and a party. For Paul, that's all very passé. Hence, he looks clearly to the most advanced capitalist countries being the gateway to communism, not because of the power of the working class, but the power of the internet, the power of high tech, and all the rest of it. And we also have, again, a very different individual, but nonetheless, someone who can put himself over as left wing, Peter Tatchell. Former Labour candidate back whenever in East London, he was gay baited by the local Labour Party, by the right wing of the Labour Party, joined the Green Party on the left. He's also calling, along with Paul Mason, for Stop the War Coalition to close down. And what this is code for is that trade unions should cease their affiliation, cease paying money. To Stop the War Coalition, should shun Stop the War Coalition, shouldn't give it a platform. That's really what all of that is about. It's not trying to persuade Lindsay German and Andrew Murray and John Rees to shut up shop. It's about mobilizing the trade unions to cut their links. It's about the Labour Party enforcing that on constituency parties. Break your links with these Putinites, and that's being done by these supposed left wingers. And it reminds me very distinctly of the Euston Manifesto, precisely at the time of the Iraq War. These people got huge amount of publicity. This is the AWL and various individuals such as Nick Cohen, people who were former left wingers in reality. Who had gone over in total to the side of imperialism, that the bourgeoisie could use as useful idiots. to dress up the war against Saddam Hussein and Iraq as some sort of anti-fascist crusade. And again, the language of the Spanish Civil War and other nonsense analogies were used. Okay, let's move on. Of course, with the defeat of Jeremy Corbyn and the Corbyn movement, we've seen a mass exodus from the Labour Party. Mainly that's been voluntary. There has been many thousands of people purged directly, that's true. But what we've got with hardly any exceptions is complete confusion amongst these people. We have no manner of different rival schemes for a broad party to replace the Labour Party. All of them absolutely, totally hopeless. Who knows what Jeremy Corbyn himself will do? There's talk of him running as mayor of London. There's certainly talk, including not quite from him, but nonetheless from him, standing in the next general election in Islington North. He said, "I will never desert my constituency." Well, to me, that's clear enough a message. Anyone, of course, who supports him will automatically be expelled. Okay, so if that's part of some strategy that had some traction, had some legs, I'd go fair enough. I mean, personally, I would urge people to vote Corbyn. I would urge people to campaign for Corbyn, but with no illusions, but what we have instead, as I said, is all sorts of stupid schemes about a broad party. The worst one and the most confused one, though, surely must be a meeting that happened a very short time ago in central London that was in Conway Hall in London, when there was a meeting convened to let's stand against Keir Starmer and let's put up a left-wing candidate against Keir Starmer, anyone with the idea of derailing a Starmer government. Well, you could derail a Starmer government. Maybe then Keir Starmer gets elevated to the House of Lords. Maybe he stands in somewhere else. But the chances of him not being elected seriously are nil. The constituency we're talking about is Holborn and St Pancras. And someone will tell me, you know, that that's been Labour since whenever. It's been Labour for decades and decades and decades. It's as solidly Labour as you can get in London. So he's not going to be ousted by some pathetic left-wing challenge. And what's the point of it? As if it's all Keir Starmer's fault. We're not talking about an individual. We're talking about the Labour right. We're talking about the Labour Party as a bourgeois workers' party. And we're talking about a Labour government, of course, that will align itself just as Rishi Sunak has in terms of being the Rottweiler of the United States. Trump, who knows? That's a different question. That will put the cat amongst the pigeons. But that's what we're dealing with, just like under Blair. We weren't dealing with Blair's determination to go to war. We were dealing with the United States' a determination to go to war. And Blair had a choice and he called it right from the point of view, perhaps, of British imperialism, where Harold Wilson called it wrong when it came to the Vietnam War. We can debate that one, but Britain paid a price for Harold Wilson's decision not to send troops to Vietnam. Anyway, I'm simply arguing that the Labour left is terribly confused and the politics of negativity are going to get you absolutely nowhere. Okay, 38. So we're sort of going to start to wind up. So this is just a few quick comments. The British press, the British media has been commenting as it would on the summit between Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin in Russia. And the line that seems to be orchestrated, because it's the same line being put out on the BBC, LBC, The Independent, The Times, The Daily Mirror. Hey, maybe it's just a coincidence, or maybe something. Here's the agenda we want you to push. Either way, the line that they're all pushing is that this shows you how isolated Vladimir Putin is, because he's seeking out an alliance with North Korea, the People's Democratic Republic of. To me, this is just delusional. We've just had the G20. This is the G7 plus, isn't it? And what did America find? It was the West, because it includes not just the West in the G20, it was the West that found itself embarrassed. So we had the resolution when it came to Ukraine watered down, and it talked about peace, and it didn't talk about Russia out and let's all unite against Russia. So if we are talking about, the big political picture, surely we have to include the fact, surprisingly to me, that Saudi Arabia is refusing, to play puppet under these circumstances, has been, not lining up with Russia, but almost taking an equidistant position, certainly cooperating with Russia when it comes to oil output, in terms of oil prices. What about China, the world's second largest economy? Is Russia isolated from that? India, the world's most populous country. Brazil, it's also part of the G20. I could go on and on. This is not just delusional, is it, comrades? This is a nonsense. So no doubt Russia will help the People's Democratic Republic with their, what they call euphemistically, their space program. And in reply for that, they will get Soviet grade munitions and other such armaments, no doubt, which they need, given the attritional nature of the war in Ukraine, but isolated, not really. No, this is not true. Okay, so that was just the comment on that one. Oh, we also have then the United States and Britain saying they will retaliate against North Korea. To do what? We have a situation of where there is still officially war with North Korea. There has been no peace treaty signed. We have a demilitarized zone. We have, a ceasefire agreement. So what are they going to do? Put sanctions on North Korea? There are already sanctions on North Korea. And precisely what we would expect under these circumstances is that the Chinese pretense of having sanctions on North Korea will become more and more, how should we put it? Well, we say one thing and we do another. That's what we should actually expect under these circumstances. So, yeah, maybe what we get is more saber rattling. I don't know what else to expect. What else can they do? They've already got sanctions on North Korea, to the point where, if they have a bad harvest, people go hungry in that country. So they can't do anything else. And precisely the lesson is, if there is a lesson on diplomatic level, if you push people up against the wall and they've got no choice in the matter, they will fight back. And of course, that's what's been happening with Russia, that you keep advancing NATO. Your agenda has been to cripple Russia. Putin rebels. He doesn't want to be a Yeltsin. FSB doesn't want Russia to become a neo-colony, and they stand up and they assert the rights of Russia. We don't support that, but hey, we do try to understand what is going on. And this isn't mad Putin. This isn't some sort of throwback to Tsarist times. This is a very understandable response under the specific circumstances which Russia and Putin find themselves in today. As I said, that doesn't mean we take sides. We are revolutionary defeatists. Okay, that's that one done. Just thought I'd mention the protests around Mahsa Amini in Iran. I don't know if Yasmin, you're in a position to write this week on it. According to the BBC, and I sort of trust them because they got an interest in the protests. There have been protests, not big protests. There's been massive clampdown, and I would expect that's an accurate picture. But we also get a picture from what Yasmin has been hammering home again and again in her articles, and that is on the streets in the urban areas is that very large numbers of women just now ignore the dress code, don't wear a veil. I heard one interviewed on the BBC again. Do you trust the BBC? No, I don't. Did I believe the interview? Yes, I did. A woman who basically described, when I go out, I'm in fear. I'm not wearing a headscarf. I could be stopped at any time. The morality police are back on the streets. I think they're now doing, facial recognition cameras and all the rest of it. So she goes out with fear in her heart, but is defying the laws. And of course, this is a symbol, isn't it? We're not just talking about, oh my God, if a woman goes around without a veil, this is going to cause a revolution. In and of itself, it's a nothing, except what we have in Iran is a theocracy that precisely defined itself in its very early phase, enforcing the veil on women. So this symbol matters, and we shouldn't dismiss the importance of symbolism in politics. It matters. So that's just my very quick comment on that. Thought it was worthwhile mentioning the big scandal of the moment in Britain. Other comments might want to comment. We don't have our media commentator, i.e. Paul Dammarty, available to write. He's writing on something else because he's getting a new job this week. So normally I would give James Dammarty the article on Russell Brand. He's a Hollywood star. I must admit, I don't know much of his work in Hollywood. I don't know much about his stand-up comedy, for that matter. I know him from St. Trinian's film, and I know of him as a guru, a health and wellness guru. I know someone who very much admires what he says. I think what he says is pretty fishy myself. Nonetheless, he has 6 million subscribers and seems at the moment, from what I can gather, to be going to the right in terms of conspiracy theories. I could be wrong because I've only read the reports that have been carried in the Times and the Sunday Times and were broadcast. I didn't see the broadcast on Channel 4 last night, but a very big article in the Sunday Times. And basically, the accusation is centered on four women. This is what he did to me, including a rape. And that would seem to be collaborated with the subsequent text messages between him and her, between Russell Brand and this woman. And what the Times are telling us is that more people are telling their story. Now, I don't know, and I'm not in a position, I don't like prejudging these stories. All I would say, though, is that if you talk to anybody who knows anything about TV, film, theatre, the media industry, and I'm talking not about local papers, I'm talking about where the money is, knows that there's nepotism and there are also demands. I won't say, well, I don't know whether that's the right word, pressures to give sexual favors, expectations that sexual favors will be given, and a management that does not question the stars. So you can get a situation, for example, as we had with Harvey Weinstein, is that people in a particular company will warn a young actress, and I use the word advisedly, a female actor, to be very careful if you're in the presence of Harvey Weinstein by yourself. And management, from what we can gather in Channel 4 and the BBC, adopted that sort of policy. Now, again, this will tend to come out. I don't know whether any criminal charges will follow. Obviously, because Russell Brand isn't just a comic, but someone who puts forward a political agenda, he's saying that there's a political agenda. Now, I'm in no position to judge that. I don't think this is the same as Andrew Fisher and Paul Mason and the Euston Manifesto and the AWL and, how should I put it, the Labour right conducting this anti-Semitism equals anti-Zionism witch hunt. I don't think that's what we're dealing with. I think we're dealing with myself, someone, i.e. Russell Brand, who had, by his own admission, we all know it, he made it public knowledge, he made it part of his persona, part of his act, that he was a heroin addict, that he had a big problem. He calls himself, also called it, called himself a sex addict. And I would have thought myself a combination of addiction to narcotics, to drugs, you know, and power could potentially be a very dangerous combination. It's precisely the power question I would emphasize. But again, we wait and see. If we want to turn to a bit of light relief and comedy, we can look at Britain and its infrastructure program. You know, we all know about Keynesianism and, you know, pump priming the economy. And what we've got in Britain is something called, let me get it right, HS2, High Speed 2. And the idea of this high speed train line, I don't know how high speed it was, actually, compared with Europe, let alone Japan and China. To me, it was a bit of a chog-chog. But the idea was to build a brand new line up to Birmingham, which is in the Midlands, but also right the way to the north of England, and I think up to Scotland. And that would make a certain sort of sense to me. Certainly having travelled up to Scotland on both lines, we have a East Coast and West Coast, and the delays are appalling. The idea makes a certain sort of sense. And for example, having a train that can replace air flight makes a certain sort of sense. Now, again, I don't want to get into cost effectiveness. And, you know, Britain is a small island, very, how should I put it, packed and all the rest of it. And to get up to a decent speed, you need a decent distance. These trains can't keep stopping at every other stop. Either way, we seem to be now, because of escalating costs, actually seriously having discussions in government of stopping this line in at Birmingham, which is just about time to get up any sort of speed, stopping it there, right? And not taking it into central London. Well, I live in sort of centrally London-y, and down the road from me, we have massive, massive works going on. This is for HS2. This is to take HS2 directly into one of the main stations in London called Euston. They're talking now about abandoning that and actually having a station that's 6 miles out. It's just mad. By the way, just worthwhile saying that because Britain was, you know, Britain was Britain, we don't have one central station in London. We have a whole series of stations on what was then the outskirts of central London. So we have Paddington, we have, I don't know, Paddington, St Pancras, King's Cross, Euston, also Liverpool Street, all doing that. But the idea of a station that's 6 miles out just makes no sense whatsoever. And I don't know what the costs there are at the moment, but I would guess they must have spent something like 60 billion already. I mean, the word madness comes to mind. Okay, so that's really for our train spotting faction. I, by the way, as I said, I'm not against rail travel. I'm all in favour of rail travel, but I'm in favour of sensible rail travel, that you can actually go to somewhere you want in speed. And that means more than just going to London or just going to Birmingham. If this high speed thing is going to make any sense to me, it surely ought to include Scotland. Okay, just a footnote on this anti-Semitism thing. This is according to the British Society for Middle East Studies and also the European Legal Support Centre. I don't know much about these bodies other than saying they are respectable bodies. They're not wacky, crazy bodies controlled by the left or the likes of you and me. And they've done a report into the implementation of the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition and examples and people that have been done under it. And what they found is that in terms of 40 cases, 38 of them were found to be baseless, and the two others haven't yet been investigated. Right? That's a figure that's worthwhile bearing in mind, isn't it? This is also, again, I haven't looked up what's happened between Ken Livingstone and the Commission on Human Rights. There is a legal case that's now been settled. I don't know what the settlement is, other than it's been settled. That does not include, by the way, David Miller. So it's 40 cases, two of which are still being looked at. Not David Miller. This is a an employment tribunal case, but 38. These people were innocent. And precisely what these two bodies are saying, look at the suffering that baseless claims of anti-Semitism has meant for academics, for people in politics, and all the rest of it. And of course, what does the Tory government do? They shrug their shoulders and saying there is no problem. Well, of course, there's no problem because the witch hunt has done its job. And what we have is the Labour left that I've already tried to describe. Okay, this is in the last few minutes. And this is, so I'll give myself 4 minutes to seven. And this is for the benefit. I don't know if Jerry Downing is here. Oh, he is. Hello, Jerry. And this is for the benefit of Jerry Downing and our comrade Daniel Lazar. And I just wanted to make my position clear because I can't be bothered to write a letter. I ought to, I know, to the Weekly Worker. Jerry, I do not believe that the Soviet Union is state capitalist. I cut a bit of your letter off this week, partially for space, but also for sanity. I would have thought that given that I've just published and I've been publishing on this stuff since the 80s, right? Really, since the 80s, why I think state capitalism as a theory is wrong. I would have thought that anybody who knew Jack Conrad knew Jack Conrad does not think that the Soviet Union was state capitalist. He thinks it's a silly idea. Daniel, and this maybe is, in terms of how I put things over, so I'm much less apologetic, or, is that the right word? Much less critical, excuse me, of what you wrote. Just to make it clear, I do not think that the October Revolution produced an ectopic social formation. I think it produced a working class revolution led by a Bolshevik party that was an example for the rest of the world to follow. Of course, we hoped that Germany would, we hope Austria would, we hope Britain, the United States would. My argument is precisely around what happens with the five-year plan. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, and if we want to talk about counter-revolution and bloodshed and violence, that's when we're talking about bloodshed and violence. The massacring of the old guard, the massacring of the Bolsheviks, the exploitation of the working class. Now, of course, I'm not asking Daniel to agree with me. I'm simply trying to explain what my position is. So my position is definitely not that the Soviet Union was state capitalist, except in the early 20s, in the Lenin Zinoviev sense. So you know, in terms of industry, you could legitimately, as Lenin and Zinoviev did, call that state capitalist, but I wouldn't call the Soviet Union under Lenin, Zinoviev, Trotsky an example of state capitalism, unless we're getting really into, you know, it was a hybrid formation. But anyway, let's put that one aside. Under Stalin and all the rest, I don't agree with Tony Cliff. I don't agree with other theories of state capitalism, perhaps more skillful theories of state capitalism. And as I said, I think a new social formation came into existence with 28, 29, that had its own inner laws that led it to stagnation. That's my argument. Anyway, that one's, as I said, a footnote. And so that's it, Stan. Thank you very much.
Okay, comrades, I'm looking for a hand raised. Otherwise, you can make a fuss in your picture.